Mask mandates don't work.
No.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Let's do it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is an hour with Dr. Robert Brennan, and my very special guest and the lady of the hour is Geraldine Hoogland. Now, in 49 BC, Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon, committing himself to war, and he said, Alea iacta est, or the die is cast. Now, Geraldine has cast her own die and entered a war zone in a sense, because she's the candidate for Lilly representing the United Australia Party, the UAP. Now, Geraldine, hence my introduction, is a Roman historian, political theorist, and she's a writer. And she's also been on a YouTube channel in the past. She hailed originally from New South Wales and has a sound knowledge of the needs of regional Australia, also having lived in Victoria but settled long ago in Queensland. She's married to Edward, a successful small business operator builder, and so she also has a knowledge of small business sector, private employment, and the needs of the workers in general. Has three children, now adults, all of them, one of whom you could say has special needs, and so Geraldine has a sensitivity and a knowledge firsthand, a lived experience with the needs of people with disabilities. And as I said, now she's the representative for UAP in the seat of Lilly. So good evening, Geraldine.
Hello, Robert.
It's wonderful to have you on the show. So tell us first about the political background you have.
About 15 years ago, 2005 actually, I started when I went to university and I didn't know which area I wanted, history or politics. I liked them both. I majored in both. I ended up doing my honours degree in Roman history, but politics. So it always, and then I started a master's and it always came back to politics, but I loved the ancient world. And because, I mean, that's where we originate from. Our political system, of course, you know, is rooted in the ancient world.
Mm-hmm.
And no better really than in Rome, people think of Greece. But when I was studying it, I realised that the best way, well, the only way really, to understand politics was to get involved. So no more sitting on the fence. I mean, I was your regular swinging voter. I hadn't paid a lot of attention when I was young, but I developed an interest in it. More, I think, in how we're governed. Society, that sort of thing. So I took the leap and I joined the Liberal Party because my husband has a small business and my leanings were more that way. So I did that and entered the fray there, and I learned. I watched and learned. I found it absolutely fascinating, and I took a real love to campaigning. So I never, ever thought or I never had an ambition at all to be a politician. And I know people do say that, but it is true for many of us. Politics is broad. It's not just about being a candidate. I guess you could say almost like an apprenticeship for 15 years in the background. So you see it all.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm a candidate. I have that really good, solid understanding of what goes on behind the scenes, of the glue that holds it all together. So I think, well, I believe that I've got the best of both worlds because I'm not coming in green. I understand the machinations, that the world is not black and white. I have a better grasp of that, I think, than when you come in green, you come in with quite ideologically, which I did in the beginning. And it took a few years and you realise the ideology, it only takes you so far.
Mm-hmm.
So, and now I left the Liberal Party a year and a half ago because over the last few years preceding that, they lost their way. Another cliche, but it's true. I didn't change. The party changed. Society changed. Maybe the people in there, too many, lacked courage. to stand up. There are a few in there that you could count them on your hand. So I left and I was politically homeless for quite some time. And Craig Kelly became the leader of the UAP, and I'd always admired Craig, and he is living proof of being a man of conviction. He left himself and had to endure being ostracised by his own party. And a few of us joined for the sole reason of continuing to be part of the political discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I had intended. But 2 days before nominations closed, I just felt compelled. That's the only word. They'd been open for 5 or 6 weeks and I still didn't really seriously consider it. But something was burning in me deep down, and that 2 days before I just felt compelled and I thought I'll try. I'll just throw my hat in the ring. I did that, left it. Weeks passed and then I got the call. And from that day, I actually haven't looked back. I've surprised myself, to be honest. I'm really not a public person at all, and I just believe this is what I need to do. Whatever the outcome, we don't know the outcome, but it's been amazing.
Yes.
And I'm really glad I did it.
You felt the calling, and some would say that the reluctant leader is the best leader. But there's a range of so-called freedom parties now. What made you gravitate to the UAP?
This country needs stability, and that the resources need to be behind it. I mean, we've had a history of the odd independent, and they hold the balance of power over the years, and probably the most successful party was the Democrats for some years. They went very, very well years ago. There hasn't really been anything like that since. But the UAP had everything. It had the ability with Clive as the chairman of the party. He not only has experience in politics, but the man has run real-world businesses internationally. He has the credentials. Craig had the credentials and capacity and ability to lead the party, and from that political point of view, he'd been in there for a lot of years. And when they started talking about the constitution and that things needed to be addressed at that level, I was in, because I have a great love of that, which stems from my study of the Roman constitution in the Republic. And so that, is my platform, which encompasses everything from freedom of speech and thought, association, and true liberty. That if you don't have that foundation of freedom to speak, to think, to choose, to associate, you don't have a liberal democracy. It is that simple. That's it.
And on one hand, I thought that, the Liberal Democrats have been around for 20 years, Pauline Hanson's party circa the same length of time. But I thought the UAP was a new thing. But when I went to the party website, I see that it references Joseph Lyons, Billy Hughes, Robert Menzies. So is there a history there, I ask my professor of history?
Not professor, well, but... you're never an expert. I mean, you always keep learning. But, I believe it has that foundation behind it because, that was the party that Robert Menzies, it was the precursor to when he then created the Liberal Party. I believe there is something in the name, the United Australia Party, and it's solid. And having that history to fall back on, to refer back on, I'm sorry, not fall, refer back on, that precedent, if you like, that has substance. And, yes, the Liberal Democrats have been around, I think, for 20 years. And I often, I wondered why they really hadn't done more in the last 10 years. So the last decade in Australia has been increasingly ruled by decree. And it's on a bit of a real train wreck, mm-hmm. Hiding to wherever if we can't make a change at this election.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. I often used to wonder why they never tried to look at doing something like this earlier, when they must have seen the signs, but they didn't. And UAP was a better vehicle, and I believed that it was the only one that was capable of, if we had a chance, to actually form government.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was just so much experience and capacity. And that is not at all in any way a criticism of the Liberal Democrats, because I've met some of them.
Mm-hmm. And your party indeed has a preferencing relationship with them.
The people in the parties. Mm-hmm. Why we choose different vehicles in the end is personal preference.
And while I've got you here on that subject, a lot have lamented, of course, given human nature, it's impossible, it was never going to happen, but a lot have lamented that all of the minor micro freedom parties didn't coalesce into one single block under one name. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it would be difficult, Robert, to actually get so many different parties who they may have the same object of attaining freedom. How it's done is very different. Who leads it is very different. You're talking about an awful lot of egos having to coalesce. How do you manage that sort of thing?
Mm.
I imagine that has a lot to do with it. I mean, look, it's human nature. People want to lead. Certain people want to lead.
Mm.
And, you know, that is extremely difficult.
Mm.
So, and yeah, that's the, well, my reasoning is what I said before. I just, for me, it suited me, perhaps because I had a history of being in the Liberal Party, which is, you know, one of the two biggest parties in Australia. I understood how they worked. So I knew I could navigate my way around that too. I understood it, and I didn't agree with everything, because in the end it's all people, which is why I left the party.
Well, yes, but after a long time with it. I guess the irony is that when we're looking at the minor parties and asking, well, why didn't they just join into one, is that the Liberal and Labor Party have gravitated to become essentially the same thing, but they remain two separate parties.
Sorry, could you repeat that? Because something happened on that audio.
I was saying that a lot in, let's say, on our side in the broad sense, in lamenting that we don't collect together as one single alternative party, the irony is that the Liberal Party and the Labor Party have drifted closer together and are essentially the same thing, and yet they remain two separate parties. I guess it's the inertia of our previous psychological state of looking at them as opponents, when really they're not so much in opposition anymore.
No, well, two words, identity politics.
Yeah.
Identity politics, and you can trace that back to the Roman world as well. I mean, it's well known that it's, I guess, in a throwaway line, people say that who haven't studied Roman history will say, you know, the brutality of Rome, you know, it has its roots back there.
Mm.
Because it at the height of when the Republic came to an end, which is the period that I studied, I didn't actually get into the Empire. I fell in love with the origin. I'm a real origin person, focus on origins. And I started, once I realised I loved Rome, I focused on the origin of Rome and up to the Republic. I mean, it's a huge area anyway, so that took my interest. So when it came to a head and was going to close, I mean, it was all about identity politics. And it had been building for a long time. It started with Sulla, who was known as Sulla the Butcher in the 80s, and he's had a bad rap in history.
Mm-hmm. And that's not the 1980s either. Yeah.
No, back in the 80s BC.
Yes.
He had a bad rap, but I studied him for quite a bit. And it's when you put it in context of the times, he was a very interesting character as far as loyalty to the Republic.
Oh.
So, yeah, it comes down to identity. And okay. that's the Liberal and Labor Party. Are just so they're the same. They're just it's just the names. There's a tag that Cicero, who was my hero in, mm-hmm. in the Roman politics, who I studied the most, mm-hmm. Says that we will now just be a democracy in name only.
Mm.
And yeah. that's all we are that's in Australia right now.
Well said. Unfortunate, but well said. And on that note, we're going to go to a small ad break. This is TNT Radio.
On air and on the app.
I listen on the app.
Stay up to date around the clock.
I listen, therefore I know.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey everyone, TNT presenter Misty Winston here. As you may already know, journalist and publisher Julian Assange is facing extradition and 175 years in prison for doing what journalists all over the world do every day. This case represents the most dangerous threat to press freedom in history. The case now sits in the hands of UK Home Secretary Priti Patel. Please contact her office and encourage her to do the right thing and refuse the extradition request. This case will forever change the future of press freedom. We can't afford to lose.
Emergency, police, fire or ambulance?
Yeah, I'm just passing through.
Police, fire or ambulance?
I can see a whole lot of smoke.
What town are you calling from?
I'm on a mobile phone.
I need the town.
Yeah, there it is. I can see flames. There appears to be a kid or something at the window.
Yes, okay.
You guys are better out. This is serious.
Hello?
000's sole job is to connect you to emergency services. If you stay focused and just answer the prompted questions, you'll get help faster.
In 2018, 2.9 million people died of the flu and pneumonia. In 2020, there was a 98% decline in influenza. But 2.8 million die of COVID? Data never lies. We mandate that the truth be told.
TNT Radio.
This is Robert Brennan and my very special guest, UAP, that's United Australia Party, candidate for Lily Geraldine Hoogland. That's the party with the big yellow core flutes and the big yellow signs saying freedom, freedom, freedom. So just before we go back to Rome, let's go to your neck of the woods, the electorate of Lilly. I'm sort of interviewing a few of the candidates from Lilly because it's a very interesting seat. It's one of the top three marginal seats in Australia, number one. Number two, there's been some shenanigans there of late. Like, for example, the sitting member is a Labor Party member, okay, but the Liberal candidate, according to The Australian, he doesn't live in the electorate and yet was trying to deceive the public that he does, number one. And number two, it seems like they've had two iterations of how to vote cards. The first one put the Labor Party above the UAP, which seems to indicate to me that perhaps they're a little bit more afraid of the UAP than they let on. And then they fixed it up, which sort of implies that they saw that they'd made a bit of a boo-boo. So what's the vibe in the electorate of Lilly? The electorate of Lilly being Brisbane North Side seat encompassing the Brisbane North Bay side. It includes one of the three biggest Brisbane hospitals, that being Prince Charles Hospital, and also the airport, which is a sort of a gargantuan operation when it's not under lockdown. So tell us what's the vibe in Lilly.
Interesting vibe. We're out a lot. We do a lot of big roadsides. We have for some time. We're fortunate to have a good campaign team, really enthusiastic people going out with all the big, like you said, yellow signs. Freedom, mm-hmm. freedom, and freedom forever, as well as other smaller core flutes and messages, message boards of what our policies are. And look, we get told constantly they want the duopoly mm-hmm. broken. Look, the majority probably that I speak with and that the other members in my team speak with are disaffected Liberal voters. There are a few Labor voters and not as many as Liberals. Interestingly, there are also a few Greens. When mm-hmm. When my neck of the woods, we have quite a decent sized Green vote in several of the polling booths. And I know people here I've known for 18 years that we've lived here. We couldn't be more ideologically, different, opposed at the political spectrum. But they've told me they will not vote Green over the mandates. It's the vaccination mandates. Now, this has got nothing to do with anti-vaccination. This has got to do with bodily choice. That's it. And that has become not just a big issue, it's a hotbed issue. I mean, most people don't just talk about it lightly. They talk about it with quite and a lot of passion, especially some of the green, normally green voters that we've spoken to. So in light of, I'm not sure, I haven't delved too much into that story, and that's clearly up to the LNP, how they handle that. But, we do get a lot of very disaffected Liberal voters. So it will be interesting to see this work itself out.
It will be, yes. And though we might have opened up the country more than we were a couple of months ago, and now even the unvaxxed can travel outside the country, this is, it must be said, because an election is coming up, and following on from the movements that some other countries in the Northern Hemisphere have made. And so it seems like they're just following on from others, A, and B, they're just appearing nice guys because an election is coming up. And so, yes, these disaffected Greens voters will be mindful of that. Yeah.
Well, there is definitely something else afoot, though, because if there is quite a bit of that being nice. I don't personally trust that they're not going to go and try to lock us down again. And
if
the reason
can.
I say that is because if they were truly serious about, oh, yes, everything's all well and good now, why did the Queensland government extend its state of emergency to October? Because that doesn't make sense if everything's all fine and dandy now. Why is the Biosecurity Act, they say that it's all good and that you can travel, but there are still so many limits within that. And also within the Biosecurity Act is contained an international health agreement. And that agreement binds us, Australia, to protect other countries around the world. Now, recently, before the Parliament was prorogued.
Yes, and that's Tedros.
That grilled the Chief Health Officer in Senate estimates, Paul Kelly and Brenda Murphy. And Paul Kelly, that's where he distinctly said it's because we have an obligation to protect other countries, because Senator Rennick questioned why there are absolutely no limits on anyone unvaccinated being able to travel overseas. And that's why it's this international health agreement. If you go and look that up, it's quite sinister.
It does. To leave the country, it's where we act in consultation with Tedros Ghebreyesus of the World Health Organization and basically get permission. Now, we can ignore that if we so choose, but we haven't been, and that was what the buck that they passed. And now the World Health Organization is working on tightening the screws of their power over us and almost 200 other countries that are part of the conglomerate. So
exactly.
Yeah. It's an empire, like a neo-Rome. And speaking of Rome, I guess the extent of my expertise on Rome is having seen Russell Crowe and Gladiator twice. Tell us something more of the lessons that you've learned historically in terms of Roman governance, how it rose, how it fell. Something that interests me is the idea that that an empire in its decadent phase, ready to die, is when it's ready to die. When identity politics enters the fray and all these sort of things. And so that it seems like there's similarity between the decadent phase of the Greeks, the Romans, the French, the Weimar Republic of Germany, and so on and so forth, and what we're facing now in the West. What's your observations, thoughts on that and other things, Rome to now?
Oh, look, I agree. There is it does mirror it. Aristotle was, most famous really of saying that you, in order to understand, what might happen in 300 years into the future, you look back 300 years into the past, you look at where you are right now in the present, and you can pretty well come up with the answer. And some historians, political thinkers as well, argue that no, there's no relationship between us and back then. I don't agree with that. I think there is a lot. And that cycle that is referred to as anacyclosis, where mm-hmm. it's that circling of the repeat, you know, it's usually done in about six segments, but if you divide it up into four quadrants, put tyranny at the top, you move along to the first quadrant, and then you have the struggle where mm-hmm. the uprising happens. And then when that happens, the next quadrant is where the people are, which is, well, in like we would term as democracy. Then the next quadrant, the third one, is termed as apathy. Now, well, apathy, I told my kids years ago, we're already in apathy. We're here. We don't know when that's going to go into the next one, which is oligarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that sound familiar? Oligarchy.
Yes.
And that's where we are. And then, of course, it ends up back at tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we're on tyranny's doorstep. Because, yes. And some people say that is so far-fetched. Why is it far-fetched? These things don't happen overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And Alexander Solzhenitsyn would say the same when he wrote The Gulag Archipelago. These things don't happen overnight. They take time. They emerge in steps. And we can see that. I mean, the last 2 years has just opened it up.
Yes.
When I first started in 2020, I mean, I have a philosophy of you live and let live, that very much classical liberal libertarian philosophy. But the minute people start saying, suddenly, you know, this thing's going to drop us all, and yet everyone I know is still standing and very healthy, 2 years on, you'd think that more people would start to question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's and getting back to the decadence that mm-hmm. you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
we are in a way decadent and in some ways not. We're almost depleted of a passion or an ambition to even achieve more. I fear we've become so dumbed down and numb. And that's called apathy. And apathy is the precursor to tyranny every single time.
Well, perhaps this slow turning unto a death of a civilization is what's mirrored within it is a slow realization of the same. It's like a Kubler-Ross cycle of grief. There might be decades of denial. There's this meme thing that goes around. I don't know who was the original author of it, but hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men. Weak men create hard times. And then it cycles around again. Hard times create strong men and so on and so forth. It's a bit chauvinistic, I should say.
We're not. It's not chauvinistic, Robert. I just don't have time for political correctness when we're talking about history, where I use it all the time. I just, mm-hmm. That's what I do. I have no time for that. You've got to put things in context.
Mm.
And we are mankind, you know.
Mm.
No, it's. I agree with that. I know that saying very well. I actually agree with it. For years and years and years, I have said the problem with our society now is there just is not enough adversity. Now, let me caveat saying, of course, some people, perhaps many people, have hard times. It's not about that. It's about the people who are not born into circumstances that they perhaps can't control, that it wasn't through their own fault. But even some of those people manage to find a way out. It's the bulk of people who have it reasonably comfortable. And if you don't have enough adversity, if you don't get challenged enough, let's put it that way better, how can you ever grow?
Mm. Yes. But hopefully the choice of what adversity you face is something that is embedded in the culture to go seek it, and that it's just that, it's your choice. It's not something that's imposed on us from without in the form of, you know, a couple of years of lockdown, so as for others to virtue signal and for others to profit from and for others to make their lives more comfortable at our expense. Yeah. And so what was the term of that cycling of history that you used?
Anacyclosis.
Anacyclosis, yeah.
Anacyclosis, yeah. It was a Greek term.
Yes. And you said that your hero is Cicero.
Cicero, yes. Yeah, so mm-hmm. I studied him. Look, he's a very people either hate Cicero or love Cicero. Mm-hmm. There doesn't seem to be anyone in the middle. I admire him. I think he gets a bad rap by some people. Some ancient, well-known historians like Mommsen, mm-hmm. who was writing way back in the early 1900s or, yeah, late 1800s, mm-hmm. I believe, and they didn't particularly like him. Some people have the hero. Julius Caesar is a hero to some, mm-hmm. and Cicero doesn't make it, I suppose, in the same heroic status, because I guess we are in a world where Caesar is put up there in general, all that sort of thing, crossing the Rubicon.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start reading all the primary sources and you learn about others, and there are so many others as well, it's just that I latched onto Cicero because I guess I related to his way of thinking, and he was a thinker. And the other thing is we owe – it is to him we owe as much as what we know of the Roman world, because there is so much of his mm-hmm. – text manuscripts that were left behind. Not all of them, of course. I'm sure they're out there buried under maybe dry earth or the Vatican somewhere. Wouldn't I love to be able to go underneath the catacombs of what they've got under there?
Oh, discover, like, what is it, the Dan Brown conspiracy of, you know, the, yes.
I know. It would be amazing.
That's my other source of expertise in history is Dan Brown. No, I'm just kidding. I haven't read his books.
You need to get the little Bibles. They're called the Red Books. The Roman books, Loeb classical libraries, they are the red ones. And for Greek history, they are the green ones.
Oh, right. No, I know about Jung's Red Book, but anyway. So, yes, and there's a Polybius figure as well, isn't it?
Polybius, yes. Well, Polybius was a Greek,
mm-hmm.
And he, I believe, got, if my memory serves, he got captured in the Roman, mm-hmm. you know, the conquering of Rome back in the second century BC. But he befriended one of the generals, Paulus, and because Polybius was a thinker and historian, he ended up tutoring mm-hmm. Paulus's two sons. So they became very friendly, and through that he fell in love with Rome in a way, and he saw the difference between Rome and Greece in that the way the Romans developed this, I mean, they wouldn't have called it a constitution back then, but we refer to it now as a constitution,
mm-hmm.
and that is where they developed, and he wrote about this in the Roman world, how they had the three layers, the separation of powers, that's what we know it as, and that's where our Western civilization traces back to that.
And that's where your expertise of history comes in, because you can see the very inception of these structures of governance, the various iterations of them over time, and how they succeeded or otherwise didn't succeed. You know, I understand that the American founding fathers were Roman history buffs also. So, you know, that sort of, although we're not talking about current affairs at the moment, trying to put forward the idea that your expertise is something that is as current now as it was 2,000 years ago. And on that note, we'll return just in a couple of minutes after a short ad break. This is TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Natural disasters may seriously threaten civilization in the future. Yet the mainstream media peddles a pseudo-scientific man-made climate crisis. Natural climate change is a real threat. And historical records show that global cooling is the biggest killer, not global warming. Cooling may arise from astronomic phenomena, including solar cycles, and volcanic activity can play a major role too. For example, in 1815, Mount Tambora in Indonesia underwent the most deadly volcanic eruption in recorded history. Enormous amounts of dust and ash destroyed crops and vegetation, killed tens of thousands of people, and the eruption led to tsunamis. The following year, 1816, was known as the Year Without a Summer, as abundant frost and ice continued all year. newspapers of the day reported extensive crop failures in Europe and the United States.
Join the pink frilly tutus.
Join the walkers, the joggers, the runners.
Join the people remembering friends, family, loved ones.
Join the kids, the mothers, the grannies.
Join those who are living with cancer.
Join those who have beaten it.
Join the most fantastic day.
Join the 5 and 10K events making a difference in the fight to beat cancer.
Join the girls this summer at Tesco and Cancer Research UK's Race for Life. Join now. Find an event near you at raceforlife.org.
Chris Domine is a husband, father, an athlete, even an Ironman. But 10 years ago, Chris's kidneys were failing.
The doctor said, if you don't get a kidney transplant, you are going to die.
Chris received a second chance, made possible by an organ donor.
Your well-being changes from loss of hope to better times ahead.
What could you make possible as an organ, eye, and tissue donor? Leave behind the gift of life. Go to organdonor.gov, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is Robert Brennan and my very special guest, UAP candidate for the seat of Lily Geraldine Hoogland, but we'll call her Jerry. So, Jerry, from ancient Rome to current affairs and to what matters to the voter, I'm just got in front of me now some of the national policies of the UAP party. And so let's go through a few of them. And you can pull in the relevance, of course, to your electorate, but these are national policies and national matters of concern. So home loans and home ownership, what's the UAP looking to do with that?
Well, we're looking literally to save people's homes. I mean, interest rates will rise. They've been already been rising in the States. Inflation's going up as well. But interest rate, we had a rate rise recently. It is going to get higher, and the idea is that via the Constitution and the Banking Act, actually, which was passed and changed by in 59 by Menzies, actually, that took the made the RBA completely independent from the government to be able to control all of that. That it's through the power of them restoring the Constitution to make an act of Parliament that gives the government powers back to be able to legislate that 3% cap for 5 years on loans, so that over these coming years, when things do get tough, that people won't lose their homes, because a lot of people could. Now, in the electorate of Lilly, according to the 2016 census data, and that's the most recent I could find on these stats of this nature, it said that 33.3% of people had a mortgage. So that's a third of this electorate that has a mortgage.
And that's representative of the country as a whole as being under potential mortgage stress.
Exactly. So that knock-on effect would be astronomical. So that's the idea behind that. And I welcome it. I think it's a really good policy because, look, I have to say up front, the United Australia Party is absolute.
Yes.
You went. There'll be real, tangible policy solutions.
If you could just repeat that last sentence.
Challenge anyone. They're blowing it out of the water with policy, with real, tangible policy solutions.
Yeah, because I guess
I challenge anyone to say it, to deny that, because Labor and Liberal, they're platitudes. Well, Labor is platitudes. We're going to protect North Side jobs, or for our part of the electorate, we're going to save Medicare. We're going to protect whatever, health and jobs. Protect Australian jobs, but they didn't. Their premiers locked us down, coerced people into losing their jobs, forcing them, if they didn't take an experimental jab, that they had to leave. So they're platitudes. And the Liberal Party are doing more of throwing money here and there. Well, where's the money coming from? We're already in $1.4 trillion of debt.
Yeah, so that's something like 12 zeros, isn't it?
Absolutely. It is. It's quite mind-blowing. And I actually do find it rather, well, it's frustrating but amusing that people would not want to see real policy solutions, real ones from the real world, saying, okay, these, I mean, maybe we don't know at the end of the day, once it's all said and done, you fine tune everything and then you have to change things, but nobody else is offering this.
Yes.
The policies that we are.
Yeah. And 1 or 2% increase in home loan interest rates might not sound like much, but that translates into a substantial change in fortnightly and monthly payments.
Huge.
Yeah, much,
cost
much
of
more
living,
than that. Yeah.
And the cost of living, of course, I mean, the cost of living, that's always front and centre of everyone that you speak to. And, you know, every electorate really would be the same with that. I mean, urban areas and regional areas would differ in a lot and various other things. But anyway, you point out some of the other ones.
No, I mean, of course we could say, well, we'll move out into the regions, you know, say out of metro Brisbane or suburban Brisbane into some place that might be cheaper like Rockhampton or something. But if you've got a job where you are, if kids are ensconced in schools, et cetera, it ain't that easy. And I notice also I'm reading that the first $30,000 of a home loan would be tax deductible. That's one of your policies.
Yes, and that's right. I mean, that is a leg up. Again, we're coming back to tangible solutions. People scream out a lot, Robert, about the government's not doing anything or the politicians don't do anything and, you know, really in many ways we've seen over the last decade or more, this has become increasingly that way, it would appear. I mean, I'm sure they do work. There's lots of work that goes on behind the scenes in the parliament and passing of bills. But how is that translated to protecting the assets and the intellectual assets and the just our nation? Now, I don't mean that's very different to me. I don't want anyone to confuse that with looking after people, because I actually believe in personal responsibility. Because government, in my view, government's role, especially the federal government, is to provide a framework where people achieve, and they must allow people to govern their own lives. We are so far removed from that that it will be a mammoth job to find our way back to that. And people have become so used to being looked after, but that will never end well. It never, ever has in history. It can't. So we are up against it. And we are, in my view, when I look back at the history that I've studied, and I'm not, no expert in everything in world history at all, but I truly believe this is a major turning point in the history of time.
It does feel like that. It does feel like there has been a serious, well, I call it a revolution, and that we're living, like, instead of BC, AD, we're living in sort of, there was pre-COVID and post-COVID. And you mentioned the national debt. I mean, part of me feels a little bit nihilistic. Is such a debt, is it possible to pay it off? And if it isn't possible, then one could be tempted to just fall into gay abandon. Oh, well, we'll just spend. Who knows what will happen tomorrow? But is it possible to pay it off? And what's your team's plan?
The plan is to put a 15% export license on a 15% price on the export, to create a export license, which was in operation in the 60s. And this is not the only country that would do it. Indonesia actually has that. So that money would be quarantined to pay off the debt, address the debt. That's what that 15%, which would come back in, would be allocated for. They have the team of people working on all of these policies. They've calculated that would take 15 to 20 years to pay off the debt. Now, 15 to 20 years might sound a long time, not compared to 180 years, which is what it would be if we didn't do something like this. So that's the situation that we're in. And, I just think it's just these sorts of policies. Again, I come back to they're real and they're tangible.
And you're looking to quarantine debt, not quarantine people. So there you go. I've given you one election slogan. You can send the royalties to TNT.
UAP is absolutely 100% against mandates. They will be gone forever and ever, and it never to happen again.
Yeah, that's a given. That's why I didn't talk COVID to death, because one of the freedom parties. And what about like tax? What's Craig and team looking to do about tax?
Well, provisional tax is going to be delayed until the end of the year. Because in small business, I mean, it's just a nightmare. We're continually, our whole lives, we have small business, is just continually looking for the tax money every quarter. That's what you do.
Mm.
And our team want to say, no, you've got to, instead of paying that before the profit, it has to come afterwards, and it's the end of the year. It's got to come at the end. Otherwise, we don't get ahead, Robert. We've found it in our own business for the last 10 years. We have worked, well, Edward has worked in the physical side of it as hard as what he ever has, and yet we don't seem to get ahead, and a lot of other small businesses say the same.
Yes, and, you know, in the economic ecology, if you have to pay this up front and not at the end, you don't get access to it to put it in your, let's say, your offset account, which can ease your mortgage stress. And so it's all it's all connected, yeah.
And actually, that's an interesting word, and that brings me to how I would try to get people to understand this is, this is a package of ideas. Mm-hmm. We aren't throwing things out there willy-nilly or at random. Oh, there's one over there and there's one over there. No, this is a package of ideas that taken together will actually form a solution to reclaiming the prosperity of this country.
Mm. And you talked about economics in a sense of a foreign policy, and although the leader of the party is Craig Kelly, the economic engine of it is Clive Palmer, and he does dealings with China as a major export partner. And so what's your take on his acumen there in the sense that he can strike a hard deal that is diplomatic, but is one that is in Australia's best interests?
He's done that all his life. I mean, he talked about that at the National Press Club address. I don't know whether you saw that. That is the great benefit. I mean, this is what he has spent his lifetime doing. So I can't imagine anyone better, more equipped, more capable. Mm-hmm. And together with Dominic Martino as well, and he headed up Delaware, the Delaware business, and of many, many others. I don't know Dominic personally. Mm-hmm. I haven't met him yet. But together with just even the two of those people, and there are so many others, we've got some talented candidates in the party. Should they win their seats, the contribution they could make would be outstanding. But to have Clive and Dominic at the head of, you know, the finance, the treasury, I mean, that's got to be a great thing.
Yeah, and I noticed that going across and looking at your candidates, that they're not professional politicians and bureaucrats and sort of party players. They're people who have had real life experience in various spheres of business and the like. Yeah.
But isn't that's what representative politics or parliament should be? That's what we've all been shut out. Ordinary people have been shut out of representation for the last lot of, you know, years. You hear, oh, well, they're not talented enough, or look at that, they're a lawyer and this, and they can bring all this to the table. Well, hang on, the nation isn't made up just of lawyers or accountants. That's it. That's it. It's too many lawyers. When it's got to be truly representative, otherwise you have to get the word representative out of our parliament. It should be. In a liberal democracy that functions as it was designed to, it should be truly representative of the people, and no politician or no one going into public office will know everything about everything. But that's not the point. People learn, you continually learn, and it's to bring all of those different elements of what you know together.
Yes. And are moving down the line when it comes to your policies. There's also, let's say, bringing super home, superannuation.
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. $1 trillion, which is, you know, only a sort of small part of what is invested offshore, we want to bring that home and invest it here. Now, some people have said to me, well, the, you know, the superannuants or the retirees would say, no, my money's earning far more overseas, there's better capital investment, etc. We say to that, our nation is in peril. We're in a crisis. We bring that money home and then we start investing it into projects here. I mean, I'm no water expert, irrigation or anything, but we all know about, you know, damming, dams running. There's so many times people have suggested great projects to get water down from the north to the Murray River, the Murrumbidgee, all of those things that are required to make this country run, the heart of the nation in the farms and in the rural and regional areas. There's got to be ways. And if the money is there and invested in those sort of projects, that is going to give back, not just monetary, but imagine that psychologically for our nation. Where's our pride? It's almost like you're not even allowed to have pride anymore in this woke, political correct world.
Yes, well, I was going to say, if you're bringing superannuation out of foreign investment and into Australian investment, it would involve a lot of confidence that Australia can make good with it.
But I think we have we have brains trust in Australia. There are ideas. I mean, look how we constantly hear people couldn't, you know, get their invention or idea off the ground here, and they go overseas. Well, keep them here.
Yes,
invest here.
Yes, one of the UAP candidates from New South Wales I interviewed, Kevin Lockray, is an engineer and inventor. Like you say, he's got some fantastic ideas. We have plenty of Australians with fantastic ideas, and they would prefer to keep them on shore. So, yeah, and another one I'm reading is about the lobbyists to, this is just borrowing a term from Trump, the orange man, you know, draining the swamp. Your party is looking at excluding lobbyists from holding official positions in political parties, from, you know, lurking around Canberra.
Absolutely. Orange man bad. Yeah, that's what they call him, gee. Miss Trump. Look, it's true. How on earth, and it's a bit like what I said before about there's not the true representation in our parliament with regular people from every walk of life. It's the same. We don't get, the ordinary person does not get the ear of government, of politicians, of ministers. The stories are legendary in that they just keep coming of people who say, I couldn't get an appointment to see my local member, or they're too busy, or they're not there, let alone a minister. But lobbyists, who are usually increasingly more ex-politicians who then go on, take a, you know, nice cushy job with a lobby firm, and then straight away the bridge, they just walk across it, straight into the politicians, or into the ministerial offices. That's not representative politics. That's not our representative democracy. We are so far away from that.
I've seen so much of that in my investigations of stories to cover on this station, that it's a little den of vipers and cycling in and out of big corporate and government and regulation. It's amazing. Well, and some of the same names turn up. Even people like Berejiklian, you know, she moves sideways into a cushy big corporate job.
Yep.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah. And so, of course, you're also looking at expansion of free speech and so on and so forth. Now, this is TNT Radio. That's the sound that the hour is coming to a close. No, Geraldine Hoogland, candidate for the United Australia Party in the seat of Lilly. Check her out on @WatchtowerRome2 on Twitter. That's @WatchtowerRome2 on Twitter. And this is TNT. Good evening.